No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. It's Maria and I tonight. Catching up on things because we both had such busy schedules. We haven't been together in a while, so there's a lot to talk about. And first and foremost,
yeah. Pardon me for interrupting. Congratulations.
No. Thank you.
Senator Michael D. Brown, reelected. And why do you think there was the competition this time around that you probably haven't faced before?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me be clear that I've only been elected to be the Democratic nominee for re-election. So I still have to run in November in a campaign where I most likely currently have two opponents. But of course, winning the Democratic primary in a jurisdiction where 80% of the voters are Democrats is the big hurdle, and that's very important. So I'm glad I did that. I have had opposition before, but not opposition like this. And I think there's two reasons. One, over the past 12 years, you know, we've worked really, really hard. I've worked really hard to make something of this office, which started out as an office where it really wasn't a whole lot. So we've worked hard. We've gotten some funding. We've gotten recognized nationally and internationally. So I think that naturally brought forth some competition. And in addition to that, there are people in the D.C. government that don't like me because I stand up for the people of the District of Columbia. And they think that I really ought to be just working for them. And I just have never seen it that way. I don't see myself as somebody that works for the city council. I see myself as somebody that works for the people that elected me. Now, that I think resulted in three members of the council endorsing my opponent and working hard to get her elected. But
wow,
in the end, I you know, to there was a lot of opposition, but I continue to be elected. There was a horrible article written about me in the Washington Post a few days before the election. It was tough, but I think there's definitely some people in Washington that want a go-along kind of person. And I just don't think that when I look at my role models, I look at people like Dr. King and Rosa Parks and, you know, other people that have struggled for civil rights and have been successful at it. And I say to myself, that's not a go-along kind of guy. Mm-hmm. It's somebody that stands up and in spite of whatever opposition may be out there. So that's what I've tried to do.
So now would you say that voter turnout was fair, average, low?
Oh, it was ridiculously low, which was one of the problems. One of the wards, there were eight wards of the city, and the ward in which I did best, only 8% of the registered voters showed up.
Oh.
92% of the voters didn't show up.
Period.
Period.
And was this the only thing on the ballot? Was
no.
this position? No, there were other things?
Oh, yeah, many other things. 480,000 registered voters, and less than 80,000 of them showed up. 80,000 of them showed up citywide. So even in your best wards, less than 20%. Or about 20%.
Terrible.
Terrible. This is the nation's capital. We're
right.
up there screaming about getting our equal rights, and so few people show up. There were several problems. Number one, the Washington Post wrote for months how there was no contest for mayor, how the two guys running against the incumbent mayor were not reasonable challengers. She had raised over $4 million. They had, between them, had raised, I don't know, maybe $100,000 between the two of them, and how they weren't reasonable. So there was nothing to vote for. There was an issue on the ballot, which people in Washington considered very important, but it didn't get, you know, came very late in the process, and that was whether to raise the minimum wage for tip employees. And every tip employee that I knew in the city was against it, but it passed. It passed, so now it's the law. And strangely enough, there was an article last week where some people are considering overturning it in city government. How can that be? How can you put a referendum on the ballot and get the input of the voters, and let the voters decide, and then say, you know what, we didn't like what you decided.
Yeah, never mind.
Never mind. So I don't know how serious that is, but if there is sentiment out there to do it, it's ridiculous. We can't demand democracy and then not practice it ourselves. That was, you know, those were the things on the ballot. There was also a city council race at large, several ward council positions up, the attorney general.
That's position, a lot.
A lot. Now, the attorney general ran unopposed. The Washington Post pronounced that every incumbent would be reelected, and they were. No incumbent lost.
Hmm.
There was one race where the council member didn't get 50% of the vote. More of her constituents voted against her than voted for her. But there were four people in the race, so she still won with 48% of the vote. But she was the only one. She was the only one that didn't get over 50% of the vote. Competitive race.
That sends you to November, getting 50% of the vote. You go to November unopposed to the November ballot.
No. You're opposed. I'm opposed by two other people in November.
Yeah, but they're not Democrats.
But they're not Democrats, right?
So that's why we don't count them.
And they're not Republicans, and they're not Green Party people. So those were the primaries. Those are the party primaries. So
tell me, how are those two on the
Republican?
How are they on the ballot in November?
They're independents.
But were they on the ballot in June too?
No,
how does that work?
They don't have a primary, so they have to run as independents. But here's the deal. I had to get nominated to be on the ballot by going out and getting 2,000 legitimate signatures. And legitimate signatures mean registered voters, registered at the address where they live, in my party. Now, the two challengers that are challenging me have to go out and do the same thing to get in the general election, but they need 3,000 signatures.
Each.
But valid signatures. But
independence.
They're independents, they can get anybody.
Okay.
They can get Democrats, Republicans, or independents can sign their petition. But that's why the bar is higher. That's why they need 50% more, because they can get anybody they want. Anybody who's a registered voter.
Right.
you know, and they have to follow all the other rules. The petition gatherers have to be electors, which mean that, you know, they're registered voters, and there are some other qualifications. They have to meet the qualifications of the office, which are the same qualifications as any Senate office would be: 30 years old, American citizen for at least 9 years, so on and so forth. But
that's pretty particular.
Yeah, but they have to be, you know, that, you know, I have to run against them in November. So we'll see what happens.
I think you should share with the listeners the position that you just fought so strenuously for, to be reelected to, is on, what do we say? There's not a stipend involved.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is on the one hand, this is a very strange position. On the one hand, it goes back to 1796 when it was first created. And it was created by people that wanted to make Tennessee a state. So they elected two United States senators and sent them to Washington. And when they got here, they didn't know what to do with them. So they just let them into the Senate. And they said, look, you can sit here, you can listen to what's going on, you can talk, you can lobby, but you can't vote. You can't be an official part of the Senate unless we make you a state. And so they fought and fought, and they became a state. They lobbied for it. They convinced the members of Congress to incorporate Tennessee and make it a state. So after that, when California wanted to become a state, it did the same thing. It elected two senators. When Alaska wanted to be a state, when Oregon wanted to be a state, when Michigan wanted to be a state, when Minnesota wanted to become a state, all these states did exactly the same thing. They, or these jurisdictions, they elected people like me. And in every case, it's worked. In every case, those states which elected people like me or those jurisdictions have become states, with the exception of Washington, D.C. Now, the difference here in Washington, D.C. is once they created the office in the 1980s and they decided they wanted to follow what now we call the Tennessee Plan, they changed the office. First, they created the offices. Then they didn't staff them. They didn't elect people until 1991.
And they, when you say they, you mean the constituents the District of Columbia?
The city council, which is really our legislative body.
I see.
We have a council that's our legislative body through home rule, which we got 40 years ago. So the council created these positions. They were never staffed. Finally, Jesse Jackson said that he would run for the office. And there was a handful of people in Washington that said, well, you know what? Jackson, who has just run for president, is a national figure. And if he's willing to do it, we should empower these offices. So they put him on the ballot. And Jackson was the first senator elected in 1991, along with a lovely lady named Florence Pendleton. So they were the first two senators. But there were politicians in Washington that were afraid of Jackson. They were afraid of him because he was a national figure. So the first thing they did was they took the salary away. The salary was supposed to be the same as a regular United States senator, but they took it away.
The city council.
The city council, yes.
Okay.
And then after that, they also took away the funding. The offices were supposed to be funded for about $1 million, and they took away the funding. Now, after 18 and 9, after 27 years, we have fought back to the point where we've gotten a quarter of the funding back, but we still haven't gotten the salaries. So I have a paid staff. I have two paid staff people. And they're amazing people, by the way. Karen,
who I met.
Right, and Rachel, and who's part time, and they're paid. They're paid a reasonable wage, not a lot. They're underpaid, I got to tell you, but they're paid regular salary and benefits, and, you know, 401k, the whole nine yards for Karen, who's full time, and. You know, a salary Rachel, who works 15 hours a week. She's paid on a part-time basis, no benefits. But anyway, so I have a paid staff, and then I have, of course, Teddy, the Wunder intern. He's our latest intern. We usually have an intern, too. So I have a staff of three people. But I don't get paid, and whatever respect I get, I get because I work hard and I earn it. I'm not the city council really works against me. And that's one of the things with this election, as I explained, you know, they think that I should just shut up and be okay about it. And I'm not. I think that when you spend $200 million to build a streetcar line that nobody rides in the district, you can fund the delegation that's been elected by the people to represent your basic civil rights. I mean, in the last election, I got 207,000 votes. 207,000 votes. That's way more than the mayor got, and it's way more than anybody on the council got. But yet, they hold us down because they can. I want to mention, give a shout out. We're moving so far ahead. I want to give a shout out to my colleague, Senator Strauss, who this week addressed the European Parliament, the European Union. He gave a speech on D.C. statehood in Brussels.
Oh, you know? Wow.
Yeah, I got back a few months ago from Portugal.
Right.
Where I stood before on the world stage and talked about statehood in front of a global conference. And I've been invited back next year to be one of the keynote speakers. And last week, I was... finalized plans for me to go again and speak before the National Council of Social Studies in Chicago, where I get to speak to social studies teachers from all over the country about our problem. So, you know, we're getting out there and we're getting it done. And it's a shame that these people don't stand up for us. It really is.
So tell me why there hasn't been any seismic movement on the city council since Jesse Jackson was elected.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if they're still keeping the position under their thumb, they started with him and now it's continued to your legacy. I would imagine that people say, if you guys can't get your act together, why should we help you? Like, why? I don't get it. I don't understand it at all. What am I missing?
Well. First of all, I mean, the short answer to that question is it's politics, right? Ironically, exactly the way Congress treats our city council, that's the way they treat us. You know, they don't let them do it. They want to always be in control. So, for example, when they gave us money, when they started to give us a little money, they put together a thing called the New Columbia Statehood Commission, which controls the money. And guess who the co-captains of the New Columbia Statehood Commission are? They're the mayor and the chairman of the city council, because they want to be in control. And that's what it's about. They can control the position, so they do. And, you know, locally, people very often think of the position as you know, a non-position. This is Washington, D.C., you know. This is what we do. You know what I mean? Imagine if you were a volunteer Hollywood producer. You know, they wouldn't say, here's Steven Spielberg, and on an equal platform, here's, Maria, our volunteer producer. Steven's got a budget of $60 million for his next film. Maria's got $1,263. You know, I mean, and that's what we get in Washington. You know, we get that pushback from people that we don't matter. You know, 11,000 people did not vote for my office. Out of 80,000 people, only about 69,000 of them voted. 11,000 didn't even vote for the office because they don't.
So they came to vote, but they didn't vote for your position.
Right.
I see. Right. So tell me this then. Does the city council not want statehood?
Well, I don't know if they want statehood or, you know, I mean, they certainly say they want statehood, but it's pretty clear they don't want us to get it. You know what I mean? If somebody gets it, they want to, you know, they want to be the people to get it, I guess. I don't know the answer to that question. You would think that they would understand that this is something you have to put money into. It's not just something that's going to happen. They put money in everything. You know, we have a $14.5 billion budget in this little, we have a city that's less than 10 miles square, and so that's $1.4 billion, $1.5 billion for every
square mile
of the city. Yeah, we're doing pretty well for ourselves. So yeah, it's pretty obvious they don't want us. They don't want to empower us for some reason. But that's okay.
Let's say in a perfect world, if you were able to get statehood, then the city council would have to legitimize your position and that of your colleagues, because that's how the United States of America works.
Yeah, except for one thing. They changed the Constitution that we passed. That's the way it's happened in Tennessee and California, Oregon, Alaska, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But these guys changed the Constitution that we passed last year. So now it says the mayor becomes governor. Everybody on the city council becomes a state legislator. And the United States senators and United States representatives get immediately kicked to the curb, and there's an election for new positions for them.
Who passed that?
The council.
The city council, but they
unanimously.
And there was no other input from other residents? It was just a city council referendum?
Well, I mean, there was inputs in that, you know, Michael Brown was screaming, you guys can't do this. This
you self-serving bastards.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I'm shocked.
We were yelling about it, but no. And then to make things worse, they then passed and this is one of the reasons that people came out against me this time. They passed a law that there's matching funds for anybody that raises money and wants to run for citywide office. If you're on the school board, if you're the attorney general, the mayor, the council, everybody but us, we're the only ones exempted. Only the people that work on statehood are not included in that legislation. There's that would be me, my two colleagues, and the delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton. None of us get matching funds. So when I made an issue out of this with the person that proffered the legislation, he said with all the smugness of a petty potentate, well, we're going to pass this in 2 days, but if you think you can get somebody to amend the bill, go ahead and amend it. So guess what? I found somebody to amend the bill. And I got six people to agree to support the amendment, six people on the council. You need seven votes. So we had six of them. And they have a breakfast before the council meeting, you know, so they can discuss things. And in the breakfast, this council member lobbied against us, and all six people that agreed to support the legislation backed out. Well, actually, four of them backed out. So there was only two left, and they didn't bring up the amendment. And at the end, when they went before the public and they passed it unanimously, I stood up at the council meeting and called them all cowards and said that they should be ashamed of themselves because they had promised to do this and then backed out and once again treated us horribly. And I just want to point out, since we're on the subject, I had nothing to gain by this because the bill doesn't take effect for a couple of years. So my election will be long over by then, and I'm elected to a 6-year term. This will be my last 6-year term because I'm
You're
not
termed out.
No, I'm not termed out, but I'll be 71. I don't want to, you know, 18 years is enough doing this. I want to do it 6 more years because we've come so far, and I want to try to complete the work I started. But the point is that I wanted us included in the legislation so that they didn't get to say officially one more time that we don't matter. We don't matter. We're the only office that doesn't matter locally. I go out in the states or internationally, and I'm respected for the fact that I'm elected. The only people that don't respect me for it are the other elected people in the District of Columbia. It's horrible.
I'm speechless, really. I just find it's bizarre to me. The sandbox is so petty, and the fact that like brighter minds or more compassionate people or more intelligent or something doesn't push through. So how much power does the city council have? It sounds like a lot.
Well, they run the city, except that Congress can tell them what to do.
Right.
But as long as Congress isn't telling them what to do, you know, like they're like political teenagers. You know, they get to use the car, they get to go out anywhere they want. And as long as mom and dad doesn't stop at the front door and say, oh, no, you can't use the car, or you can't do this, or you can't do that. They can do whatever the hell they want. They pass laws. They have a $14.5 billion budget. Now, in New Hampshire, because they have a 435-person legislature, if you took the budget of New Hampshire and divided it by 435, each person in the New Hampshire legislature would control a few million dollars. But in the District of Columbia, each member of the city council, all things being equal, controls over $1 billion. So they have a lot of power, a lot of power. But it's conditional power. Congress can interfere with it anytime they want.
And they have.
And they have from time to time, but not on a regular basis, because Congress has its own problems.
Right.
So, in general, they don't interfere. But yes, they can interfere when they want to interfere, and they do from time to time, mostly through the budget. They just take things out of the budget they don't like. One of the most prominent examples is that we had a needle exchange program in our budget for 10 years, which Congress didn't like, even though the CDC were the people that encouraged us to do this, to reduce the spread of AIDS. And until we became the number one place in America with new AIDS cases for 10 years in a row, Congress took it out of the budget. So they can mess with this, and they do on a regular basis. But in general, the city council and the mayor run things. And we have a strong city council. And, you know, that means they're elected, not appointed by the mayor. So they work in opposition sometimes to the mayor. But, you know, those are the two components that run the city. Now, the mayor has given herself $1 million to work on statehood, even though they fund our offices. Look, this is what I get for travel, staffing, for everything. I get $75,000 a year to staff two positions and pay for anything else I have to pay for.
You're kidding.
No, and the mayor gave herself $984,000 to work on statehood alone. It's kind of crazy. It's crazy. And, you know, I think that they should do more to support these offices, which have always worked, except in with the exception of District of Columbia, but they just won't. And they people don't like the fact that I stand up to them.
Wow. And then you do it for bupkis, as the Yiddish expression is. Yeah. And you had to fight to do it, and you had raised money to do it, and you had to spend money to do it. And God bless you, Michael.
Well, you know what?
I mean, really.
It's just not about money for me, you know, and I don't think it is for the other people involved. I believe, as President Kennedy used to say, that to whom much has been given, much is expected. Mm-hmm. And much has been given to me, Maria. I mean, I have a beautiful, intelligent, wonderful wife, three perfect children. I was an orphan who people took, you know, interest in and helped me along the way. My brother and sister and other people. I've always found ways to give back. You know, I haven't been This isn't my first volunteer job. I was a volunteer commissioner. I worked on the board of directors of my church. I'm like you. You've had a lot of these too. There are certain people, I say this to people all the time, young people, be careful what you volunteer for because it becomes contagious. Yeah. You know, you volunteer for one thing, you tend to volunteer for more and more and more and more. And I've always done that in my life because it's not just about money. It's about, you know, it's about making a difference for me. And boy, it sure would be nice to do something like this, make the District of Columbia a state, change the world forever. Because once we become a state, that's it. Nobody's ever had their statehood revoked.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, it is, and studying that a bit too in positive psychology last semester, the philanthropy does feed upon itself, as you say. Be careful, because when you give, it usually makes you feel good, and you're not giving to feel good, but you're giving because you're moved to give. And then it's kind of this self-completing cycle, which is an upward spiral instead of a downward one. So you're right. You know, it's infectious.
Yeah. And you know what? Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. You want to feel good? I used to work at a soup kitchen with my kids. You want to feel good about yourself? Go feed a hungry person. You feed a hungry person, it makes you feel great. Let me tell you.
Yeah. And fortunately, 501c3s are alive and well and in abundance, and people are helping to make this world a better place.
Yeah.
And, you know, one footstep at a time. And it's not about money either. It can be time, it can be treasure, or it can be talent, is what I like to say. So any one of those resources are valuable.
Well, and the American people, now not the American government necessarily. American government is a very giving government, but there are governments in the world that give more of their GNP to give it more of it away than we do. But nobody on the planet gives as much as American citizens give. American citizens are the most giving people in the world. They give the most money, they give the most time, they give the most effort. And, you know, and I think, again, it's because so many of us realize how lucky we are to live in a country where, you know, you can be free and you can become what you want. That you know, you have all these rights that are protected, as imperfect as this country is at times. You know, I'm not trying to say that we don't need to improve things, but I think a lot of us realize how lucky we are to be in a place like this, and we want to give back, and so many people do.
Well, and that was what one of the things we wanted to discuss is, speaking of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old progressive female, non-white, and there she puts everybody in shock.
And you know what? This is something that, unfortunately, I think as a Democrat, we need to wake up to. We haven't woken. We have these T-shirts that say "Stay woke." Well, I'm not sure we woke up yet. I think we're in that dream state in between where you're, you know, fast asleep and you're not yet awake. And this was certainly a sign of that in New York, that this woman that nobody had heard of beat a long-term incumbent who was entrenched. I think that what you and I just talked about in terms of what happened in Washington, D.C., with only 8% of the people coming out, you know, it's the same thing. It's that people are just, they're just throwing up their hands and saying, we don't like the way things are going. We want change. And in D.C., I think they were saying, we don't like the way things are going, but we don't know what to do about it. So we're just not going to be involved. But you know, they're different sides of the same coin, I think.
Well, I think what the wake-up call is for your party is that the old white guy regime, or if you include Nancy Pelosi in there, the you know, the white people regime, people are done with. They want to have, like you say, they want change. I think they, and the people who apparently seem to be more active now were the younger voters. It used to be the Gray Panthers, you know, right. Anybody who was a senior, because they had the time and the passion and they were able to delve into the issues in more detail. But this woman, because she worked for Bernie and then she considers herself a socialist, really, she was exciting to people. It gave them something to leave their homes for, to vote for, instead of the 56-year-old white guy who is just like the three ahead of him, Pelosi and Hoyer and Clyburn, who, you know, well, are in their late 70s.
Well, I think that is part of the sentiment. And, you know, it's amazing because the comedians last night were making a joke and they said that she calls herself a socialist Democrat, but she's thinking about changing her title because she finds that, you know, most people don't understand that and that it's incendiary. So she's going to drop the term Democrat, you know, and isn't that sad that that's the joke, right?
Yes.
That there's some that, you know, there's a ring of truth to it. I think that's true. I think people are, you know, the Democrats still haven't caught on to the fact that they're looking for change. You know, I read Hillary Clinton's book and the first thing that I noticed about it was the title. And the title of the book is What Happened. You know, now look, let me tell you something, Democrats. I know what happened. You're not getting it. That's what happened. You know, right. I as soon as I looked at the title of the book, I'm like, what is this? What happened? What happened is we lost. Let's look at why we lost. Let's not act like it was some kind of aberration that, you know what I mean? Like, you know what happened was it was Tuesday and nobody was at, you know, and this, we didn't do this and we didn't do that. No, we didn't connect with the people. And unless we do connect with people, it's going to happen again.
Well, you know, the same reason that simple. She got elected is why Trump got elected. People were sick of the status quo.
And again, so she brought the same point.
Yeah. She brought some excitement. She brought color. She brought youth. She brought enthusiasm. She brought social media. She brought all the stuff. I'm sure that Crowley didn't, because he didn't have to. He had been elected enough that it wasn't what he had to do. Right. So I don't think it's a bad thing at all for both parties that maybe we don't want to keep doing things as we've done, and maybe we do want it to shake up. I just don't know how qualified she is. I don't know that, but she's obviously smart, so she's going to be a quick learn, and I guess she can learn on the job. As President Kennedy said when he appointed Bobby to be Attorney General, that, you know, he'll learn.
Well,
he'll figure it out.
Well, you know, I hope that you and America will take solace in this quote from Mark Twain, who used to call Congress the home for the criminally inept. You know, that's right. How qualified do you have to be sometimes to be up there? I don't know you know, it's a funny thing about politics that people have to like you. It's different than most other things. You know, you can go to a doctor that you don't like. Pat and I had a pediatrician one time that we didn't like, but we thought he was a great pediatrician. You know,
I had the same.
Yeah.
No bedside manner.
Bedside manner. You know,
but I always say I don't hire people for their personality.
Right. But he's a good clinician, and we thought he took good care of our kids, and that's all we cared about.
Right.
But in politics, you got to like people, and it's strange, you know. And I guess one of the main embodiments of that is Hillary Clinton, that people would say, oh, you know, she's qualified, but I just don't like her. There's something about her I don't like, you know. And so, I'm not sure that our New York congressman was a likable character, and this woman certainly was. So I think it's time to wake up. But you know, I've got a couple of things I want to talk about. We're running out of time here because we've got so much to talk about. But one thing that I think I just want to bring up is that Puerto Rico has now put in a statehood bill.
Have they?
Yes, and they have 21 Republican co-sponsors of the bill.
Oh, as it goes my. In.
We have 159 co-sponsors on our bill in the House, and all of them are Democrats. The Puerto Ricans have 21 Republicans and 14 Democrats sponsoring their bill from the get-go. So the governor this week called it a matter of civil rights. And Jennifer Gonzalez Colon, who is the resident commissioner, put in the bill. You know, Puerto Ricans have been citizens of the United States for more than 100 years. And they after the hurricane realized that there was a lot of federal aid that was slow to come and that they weren't treated the same way they would have been if they were a state. And this has, you know, generated a new call for statehood in Puerto Rico. And we've already met with the Puerto Rican delegation. And me and my colleagues met with their, they have a delegation like ours. Unlike ours, it's been appointed, not elected. You got people probably know that senators were first appointed. They weren't elected. It took an amendment to the Constitution to before we started electing senators. So they've gone back to the old system and appointed them. And
you said that was bipartisan, too.
Yes, bipartisan. And they have five members of the delegation who are representatives and two senators, and they have, and are pretty heavy duty people. One's a former governor. Two are former leaders of the Puerto Rican Senate. One of them's a Hall of Fame baseball player who named Pudge Rodriguez, who coincidentally finished his career at the Washington Nationals. But so that, you know, one of them's a retired general. I mean, they put some pretty heavy-duty people on top of this. They're very serious about it. And, you know, you've probably heard recently that California has passed the first hurdle to get a referendum on the ballot to divide it into three states.
Yes.
They want to, what do you think of that?
I'm not a fan of it because it's Southern, Central, and Northern California, and I think they're going to let Southern California call themselves California, and the others have to have some kind of Middle California or Coastal California or something like that. But I think it just dilutes us. But I understand why they're doing it, because ideologically we are divided geographically quite a bit. Southern tending to be a little more conservative if you go south of Los Angeles, whereas Northern California and the Silicon Valley, they tend to be much more liberal. And then the Central Coast, that's a lot of agriculture there. Farming, so they can be more conservative, but I just think it would dilute us in general. I mean, we've got the fifth largest economy in the world. Why would we want to take that away from the table? I'm not a fan of it myself.
Well, and as a statehood advocate, I can tell you the one thing that really scares me about it is will that become a precedent for other states?
Right.
Like Texas. Virginia. Yeah. Like Virginia is a good example for me. Northern Virginia is solidly Democrat. The rest of the state is solidly Republican. There have been people over the years who have suggested that that D.C. and Northern Virginia should form into a new state. That way the Republicans would get something out of it. They would get a solid Republican state and we'd have a solidly Democratic state. But that bothers me. You know, would we start doing that? Would New York do that? Upstate New York as opposed to Manhattan? And you know, there are places that are dramatically different. You know, you can't New Orleans has nothing really much in common with the rest of the state. Manhattan has really very little in common with the rest of the state. You know, so that's what worries me about the California thing. But so, we'll see that. That's interesting. It at least gets more people talking about the idea of statehood.
Tell me what now with the Puerto Rico, where does this go from here?
Well, they're in the same position we are. They would have to get their legislation through both houses of Congress and have them have the president sign it. Now, some of the differences between the two of us is that we would get one representative. They would get five because representatives are based on
population.
We would be one of the richest states, maybe even the richest state. They would be the poorest state. They would, their per capita income is half what Mississippi's is. Those are some big hurdles for them to overcome. But like you say, they've been citizens for more than 100 years. I've already made a statement, put out a press release saying that I stand firmly behind them in their quest to do this. If this is what the citizens of Puerto Rico want to do, I think this is what we should do. But they've got some hurdles to overcome. And we've talked about working together because, as you know, a lot of states have come in through what was called the Missouri Plan, where slave states and non-slave states came in, and Republican and non-Republican states, you know, Republican, Democrat states come in. So that was the case in Hawaii and Alaska. So we look forward to working with them, but we both have kind of different problems that we have to address. And they've really looked to us for some guidance.
Bet they have. Why should they reinvent the wheel? You've
right.
been at it.
Great. And we have ongoing talks with them, and we're working with them. I also want to say something quickly about the shooting at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis. I'm sure you've heard about this.
Yes.
That five journalists were murdered. Well, in a strange kind of coincidence, when I was 17, I was a union truck driver, and the Capital Gazette was one of my customers. So it's a place where I have been many times as a young person. It was a tiny little, I'm not even sure it was called the Capital. It may have turned into something else, but it was the Annapolis newspaper at the time, the same location. My deepest sympathies mm-hmm. go out to all the people that were connected to this lovely little newspaper, who, by the way, put out an edition the very next day. That's how dedicated they are. And we've got to stop this craziness. I don't know what gets into people that, you know, this guy had some grievance with the newspaper.
Yeah.
Hell, I'm in politics. I have a grievance with a lot of newspapers. You know, I mean, the Washington Post just wrote a horrible article about me recently. You know, that was mostly untrue, in fact. But, you know what I do? I sit down and write a letter to the editor. That's mm-hmm. what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And they published my letter to the editor. I don't think about hurting people. I don't know why we do this. I really don't. Is it for the 15 seconds of fame you get?
I think it has much more to do with the pathology of what's going on, what's wrong with them, than what they're looking to get out of it. So yeah. It's the ultimate case of bullying, if you will, that they think they have nowhere to turn but to turn to violence. There was a man he stabbed 9 people at a children's party, 6 of them children. I mean, stabbing. They call that stabbing, they say, is an act of passion. You're close to your victim, you know.
Right.
I mean, your fist is slamming into them as you're wielding that knife. And it's just, it is, it seems like it's becoming more prevalent. I don't know. That's something, gun violence, I was thinking about studying, and I just decided I don't have the heart for it. I really wanted to study things that are going to improve our quality of life. Not that that wouldn't, you know, the eradication of it, but things that will make the human condition better, or the human race a better race, or what have you. That's how I want to put my efforts into it, the glass half full kind of thing. And speaking of that, though, what about Justice Kennedy? I hear President Trump is going to make his nominations a week from tomorrow.
Yeah, well, this is something that we don't have time to talk about in 4 minutes, because it's a big deal. But let me tell you, one thing I want to say about that is that Lindsey Graham was on TV today saying that he better be careful about playing too much to his base, because Roe v. Wade is a, you know, that's something that he's already spoken to, and it's something that conservatives care deeply about, his base. But they've got an election coming up in November, and you want to upset women in America, you put the guy in there that's going to overturn Roe v. Wade. You put somebody in there like that, and I think that's going to cause Republicans a lot of problems in November. It's one of the litmus tests for women. So I think that's something you have to be very careful of. And I think there's, of the five people on the short list, there's a couple of people that fall into that category. So they're going to have to be careful with that. And they're going to have to, it'll upset women, but because then the nomination process, it will go on for months while people are trying to
discredit
run election.
Right.
There'll be these people up there discrediting and people on both sides of the aisle running for cover. So this is going to be a test of what his political acumen really is, I think, as to whom he picks and, you know, how that goes forward. So we'll see. That'll be interesting. In the next few weeks, we'll have to talk more about this. But
yeah, because I hate it that abortion is a part of the Republican platform.
I know a lot of women do.
And I've said it for decades, and I even did a MoveOn.org petition to have it removed, and it got no traction at all because you Democrats want us to keep it in there because we shoot ourselves in the foot because of that, and the people who are strongly Republican want it in there, so there's no place to go with it. But it need not be a part of politics. That is a personal medical decision between a woman and her healthcare provider, and politics should have nothing to do with it, regardless of how you feel about it.
Well, and you know what? I think that your party should take note that you're a good Republican and that's your opinion. And there are lots of good Republicans that have that opinion. So, you know, it's something they really, like, again, I think Lindsey Graham hit the nail on the head that they need to be careful about that. But we'll take this up again. Okay. I can't allow the 4th of July to come without giving us both a chance to say something. And this is what I want to say. I want to say that with all its bumps and bruises, America is still a wonderful place. It's a place where, at least when I grew up, I was proud to stand up and put my hand over my heart and salute the flag. It's a place that's given me great opportunities and continues to provide opportunities, more opportunities for people than any other place in the world. So on the July the 4th, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, a Green Party person, a libertarian, whatever your political persuasion is, make sure you take a moment to realize how lucky each and every one of us is to be here in the United States of America. And I'm going to leave the last word to my colleague and dear friend, Maria Sanchez.
Thank you, Michael. And so well said. And even I think the best part about America is that we do have warts and that we are human. And yet we have an environment where we're allowed to share our feelings and express our opinions and hopefully engage in respectful discussion and discourse, because at the end of the day, we still do care about each other and about our planet and about our world. So God bless America.
Can't say it any better. And here's we're going to leave you with the Beatles tonight. As much as we have warts, listen to what they have to say. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's all right. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out. In the capital of this nation, 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.